Please welcome Wendell Potter.
My goodness. Don, thanks very much. And thank you all. Thanks, Mona, the board, the staff, for inviting me back. I'm truly honored to be back here at DFA. The last time I stood before you, it was in 2013. And to a certain extent, we were in a countdown mode then, waiting for the most far-reaching provisions of the Affordable Care Act to take effect. And we were hopeful, but we were pretty anxious at the same time about what was to come. Well, although, as we all know, the rollout was pretty rocky, many of the systemic changes that I had called for in my congressional testimony and that you all had been fighting for, they remain intact. As a result, more than 15 million Americans are uninsured. Lifetime and annual limits on insurance policies have been swept into the dustbin of history. Millions of Americans who were blackballed by insurance companies because of a quote, unquote, pre-existing condition are now able to come in from the cold. And an untold number of lives have been saved. So folks, the ACA is a survivor. We can pat ourselves on the back for a minute, because as we all know, a lot more reform is still needed. If the ACA had been a Google product like Gmail or a Google Maps, we'd have launched it as a beta release. And we'd be looking forward to the next version. I've often called the Affordable Care Act the end of the beginning of reform, but because of the current state of affairs in this town, we're stuck in the beta phase. With 30 million Americans still uninsured, we have no ethical choice but to keep pushing for ACA 2.0. Now, that might seem right now like a fool's errand, but we can't stop our advocacy because of the dysfunction that currently defines Capitol Hill. I'm here today as a former insider who realized before it was too late, thank God, that I was part of the problem. I hate to admit this, but for years I saw people as numbers on a spreadsheet, not really as human beings. It was numbers devoid of flesh and blood that insulated me from doing what was right. Since my change of heart and career, I'd prefer not to cite numbers again, but you sort of have to use them, as I did a few moments ago, to explain the success of the ACA. But those numbers, as impressive as they are, can't even begin to tell the whole story. To understand the true impact of the Affordable Care Act, you have to tell the stories of individual Americans whose lives have been changed for the better because they now have access to the care that they need. Just this past week, I talked to a young man who told me he was worried constantly before the ACA was passed whether he'd be able to continue to afford the medicines that he needed to take for his MS, expensive medications that he knows he'll have to take for the rest of his life. Because of the ACA, he now has some peace of mind. Speaking of stories, some of you have heard, as Don alluded and Stan mentioned, one of mine. It was that one about my epiphany. And it was in July of 2007. I was back home in Tennessee. I was thumbing through my hometown newspaper, the Kingsport Times News, when I came across a story about something called a healthcare expedition that was being held a few miles away from where I grew up in Wise County, Virginia. At the time, I was still head of corporate communications at Cigna. It was such a compelling story that I decided to go check it out. John Edwards, I think, had been there just the day before. It was a campaign season. To this day, I can't shake what I saw when I got to Wise County, to the fairgrounds, later that morning. This health fair, as I said, was called an expedition, and for good reason. Not only had the organizers and caregivers traveled miles to get there, so had many of the patients. Some had driven from as far away as Ohio and South Carolina. And some were missing work. Undoubtedly, they were missing work, putting their livelihoods at risk to get the care that they needed, but they just simply couldn't afford. As Don mentioned, there was a steady drizzle that morning, but that didn't keep the folks from lining up by the thousands well before sunrise. And many of those folks had slept in their tents and were in their cars the night before. And as Stan mentioned, they weren't there just for get their blood pressure checked. What I witnessed really looked to me like a MASH unit in some war-torn country. People were on gurneys everywhere you turn. there was no expectation of any privacy. This was my introduction to remote area medical, and it was also my road to Damascus. Stan Brock, who I'm honored to call my friend, as he said, founded remote area medical in the 1980s as a way to take healthcare to some of the world's most, the world's poorest and most out of the way places, places like Haiti and Guyana. But pretty soon word got out in this country about Stan's expeditions. He got a call one day from Hancock County, Tennessee, which is about an hour's drive from RAM's headquarters in Knoxville and about an hour's drive from Kingsport, Tennessee. They called and asked Stan if he would stage an expedition there in that county. He said that the county's only dentist had recently closed his office, leaving people there without easy access to dental care. Well, since that first expedition, Stan has had to scale back his international work because of the growing demand in this country. I'm sure that Stan probably thought that he might be able to scale back his work here in this country after the Affordable Care Act was passed. But in the 5 years since it became law, the crowds at those expeditions have only gotten bigger. Well, why? Because of the special interests that call the shots here in Washington. They made certain that any reform bill that reached the president would meet their needs first and foremost. I don't think there's anyone in this room who would say that the law that we wound up with was the law that we hoped would get passed. It fell far short of getting us to universal coverage. And it's not only not doing nearly enough to ensure that people, even with insurance, can get the care that they need, care that's affordable. One of the reasons that care is still unaffordable for many Americans is because the law doesn't do nearly enough to control healthcare costs. The special interest wouldn't allow that. So thousands of people are still filing for bankruptcy every year because of medical debt, even people with insurance. The Kaiser Family Foundation released the results of a survey just a few days ago that helps to explain why that is. Although the increase in the cost of premiums has slowed over the last decade, the cost of deductibles has grown 7 times faster than wages. Now, I'm not a bit surprised. One of the reasons I left the insurance industry was because I couldn't, in good conscience, be a cheerleader for high deductible plans that we euphemistically called consumer-driven health care. I knew from the very beginning that these plans would be a bad deal for millions of Americans. I hate to say I was right, but I was right. These plans are really hurting many of us. You don't have to take my word for it. Just ask Stan. People who have coverage, but coverage with high deductibles, are showing up at RAM expeditions in increasing numbers. I was actually told by your staff, Stan, once that some people said that their insurance companies had asked them or suggested that they call RAM to find out when there might be an expedition in their towns. Yeah, you can count these folks among the insured, because of their relatively low incomes, many of them can't use their newly obtained ACA-enabled coverage. Folks, high-deductible plans were dreamed up by high-paid consultants who've never walked a day in the shoes of a woman who had to take a day off from work and drive hundreds of miles away to get care at one of Stan's expeditions. High-deductible plans are pure and simple, little more than a new way to ration care by income. How many of you have heard of Uwe Reinhardt? Dr. Reinhardt is a professor of political economics at Princeton. He's an uber health policy wonk, too. He knows more about the world's healthcare systems than just about anybody I know. Here's what Uwe said in a recent interview about consumer-driven healthcare. The idea that you can have high deductible policies and that you're not rationing healthcare by income status, I would say, where were you educated? That doesn't even require a PhD. It's just common sense. Think of a waitress making $30,000 and you ask her to cough up $10,000 out of pocket. Well, you and I both know that she's not going to be able to do that. High deductible plans are forcing people to choose between rent and healthcare, between food and healthcare. This is one of those barriers to care that we must figure out how to take down. But know this, we will get fierce resistance from my former colleagues. Here's something I know for a fact. The insurance industry's goal is to move every last one of us into a high deductible plan. And they've almost got that job done. In the last 8 years, the percentage of workers with annual deductibles shot up from 55% to 80%. And the deductibles creep up every single year. As I noted earlier, many people not only are not going to the doctor when they should, many of them are not able to get their prescriptions filled either. How many of you have heard the name Martin Skrull?
Don't recognize his name.
You know him probably as the latest most hated man in America. He's overtaken that guy who shot the lion in that dentist. Exactly.
your best friend?
That's right. Skrelly is the 32-year-old former hedge fund manager turned drug company CEO who decided to jack up the price of Daraprim from $13.50 a tablet to $750 a tablet just to reap a windfall profit. Only in America. And I mean that sincerely, only in America. We are the only country in the developed world where Skrelly could have gotten away with that. While his avarice and his arrogance made headlines, this was no isolated case, as you all well know. The cost of drugs is increasing faster than anything else in healthcare. That's because we have no national policy that would make that kind of profiteering unlawful. And the reason we have no national policies because of the fact that the pharmaceutical industry owns this town. It is that ownership that explains why Medicare is barred from negotiating with drug companies. It's that ownership that makes it illegal for U.S. citizens to re-import drugs from Canada. Notice I said re-import. We can't even get drugs from Canada that were made in this country without running the risk of getting arrested. High deductible plans and outrageous health drug costs are two remaining barriers to care, but they're certainly not the only ones. Of the other barriers, there's one in particular that I'm working to bring down. And you might know from what Stan said what that is. It's dental care. I was shocked when Stan first told me that at least two-thirds and up to 90% of the people who come to his expeditions are there primarily for dental care. Most of the folks who line up, who travel hundreds of miles to sleep in the cars, are there to see a dentist. And they do that because their teeth and gums are in such bad shape. Remember that the first people to ask Stan to do an expedition in the U.S., the folks in Hancock County, Tennessee, did so primarily because of the lack of access to dental care. Improving access to dental care in this country is one of my new causes. I've been writing a series of columns for the Huffington Post, and giving presentations all over the country to put this crisis on people's radar screens and to offer ideas about how we can solve it. It might or might not come as a surprise to learn that the main reason one of the most cost-effective solutions to this crisis, a crisis that was largely ignored, unfortunately, by Congress as the ACA was being drafted, is the influence of another mighty special interest in this town, organized dentistry. So why do so many of us lack access to dental care? Well, here are just a few reasons. 130 million Americans, one of every three of us, have no dental benefits, and that includes most of our senior citizens because Medicare doesn't provide dental coverage. And only 20% of dentists are willing to see Medicaid patients. We also have both a shortage of dentists and a severe maldistribution of dentists. Most dentists practice in well-to-do suburbs, not in rural areas and low-income areas. In states like Maine, there's only one dentist for every 2,300 people. 50 million of us live in what's referred to as dental deserts. Hundreds of counties in this country, like Hancock County, hundreds have no dentists at all. There's also very little diversity in dentistry. It's still an incredibly white profession. Only 5.5% of U.S. dentists are African American, and only 6% are Hispanic. So, well, you may be asking yourself, this affects me how? Well, untreated dental problems can lead to trips to the emergency room and the graveyard. The Washington Post a few years ago ran a really heart-wrenching story about a 12-year-old boy who lived just a few miles from where we were meeting today. DeMonte Driver died because of an infection that began in his mouth and spread to his brain. People die every year in this country because they don't have access to dental care. In an average year, doctors who, as you know, are not trained in dentistry try to treat hundreds of thousands of patients in the ER for problems that could have been resolved more appropriately and less expensively by a dental professional. We know that we know actually what one of those solutions to this crisis is: licensing mid-level dental practitioners. But implementing that is a huge challenge because of opposition from organized dentistry. Still, we're making some progress. The first state to overcome the American Dental Association's formidable opposition was Alaska. And Alaska was the first because Alaska natives, many of whom live in very remote villages, had endured a chronic shortage of dentists for generations. Tribal leaders up there finally turned to mid-levels as a solution, a solution that 50 other countries have been using for years. Called dental therapists in most places, these mid-levels have a limited scope of practice, just as nurse practitioners and physician assistants do. But they're making a huge difference wherever they practice, especially in Alaska, where the dental therapy program recently celebrated its 10th anniversary. Many villages in Alaska are now seeing cavity-free kids for the first time in anyone's memory. Support for licensing dental therapists is spreading to the lower 48. Minnesota was the first state in the lower 48. Maine was the second to pass legislation to allow them to practice. And it's a movement that has bipartisan support because it represents a true free market solution to a very big problem. One of the advocates, by the way, is none other than Mr. Free Market himself, Grover Norquist, who I interviewed just a couple of weeks ago. Grover has written letters to legislators in a number of states urging them to remove the barriers to dental therapy. On the other end of the ideological spectrum from Grover are groups like the Black Healthcare Coalition of Kansas City. So why hasn't every state followed Alaska's lead? Well, the American Dental Association is behind a PR and lobbying campaign to persuade lawmakers that dental therapists provide substandard care. But they can't cite a single study to back up their claims. And that's because there are no such studies. I've been to Alaska a couple of times. I've seen how they've trained, how they're trained, and how they serve their communities and the gratitude of their patients. So one of the things I want you to do is join my good friend Grover and me in advocating for this cost-effective solution to what former Surgeon General David Satcher called a silent epidemic. It's not the only solution, but it's a vitally important one. Despite my dwelling on these remaining barriers to care, I think most of you know that I was and continue to be an ardent supporter of the Affordable Care Act. But toward the end of the healthcare reform debate, specifically when it became clear that we were losing the public option, something clicked into place for me. My years as a PR executive for the insurance industry, combined with my more recent experience as a healthcare reform advocate, came together in somewhat of an aha moment, sort of like that aha moment I had in Wise County. It became clear to me that the game is rigged, that the influence and power of money was so pervasive in Washington that money itself is the biggest barrier to real reform. Conditions that contribute to obesity, to asthma, cardiovascular problems, poisoning, the list goes on and on. They occur at a frequency they do because of a common thread: big money in politics. Now, I'm going to repeat myself because it sounds absurd on its face. Big money in politics is making us sick, and in many cases, it's killing us. Now, let's start with guns. You know all too well that the brilliant doctor who founded this organization was nearly denied an appointment as Surgeon General just because he displeased the NRA for daring to suggest that we need to address gun violence. Now, the NRA, of course, is no exception. Yes, it's an innovator in influence, and its methods are copied, but in almost every sector, it has a counterpart. As doctors, when you see gunshot victims, you immediately see the link to a public healthcare crisis. But what about other patients who show up in your offices or who fill your hospital's ERs? Have you ever stopped to think that many of those patients might never need to see you in the first place or go to the ER if it weren't for big money in politics? Probably you've never thought about that. Earlier this year, the New York Times published an expose about the dangerous chemicals used in nail salons. Shortly before that, 60 Minutes broadcast an investigation about a company called Lumber Liquidators. What did these two stories have in common? Formaldehyde, which is a known carcinogen. Did you know that of the 80,000 chemicals that are commonly used in products we buy every day, only a tiny fraction are actually regulated? And those that are often poorly regulated. In the 60 Minutes segment, we learned of a husband and wife who became sick after installing new flooring in their homes. It turns out that Lumber Liquidators had sold them flooring with off-the-charts levels of formaldehyde. The upper respiratory issues from formaldehyde exposure that plagued this Michigan couple were also found in many of the survivors of Hurricane Katrina, who were living in trailers that were provided by FEMA. Many of them became very sick, and some of them actually died. Of those who were tested, 95% had excessive levels of formaldehyde in their trailers. Congress eventually passed legislation in 2010 to restrict or to ban several toxins. But folks, a lot of monkey business can happen in this town after a bill is passed and regulators start writing the rules. To this day, special interests have been able to delay the EPA's implementation of most of the provisions of that law. So who's the NRA in this story? It's the American Chemical Council. This trade group and its corporate allies don't want additional regulations, and that's because the status quo is really quite profitable for chemical companies and many other big corporations with names like BASF and 3M and Georgia-Pacific, ExxonMobil and Chevron, and on and on. Their annual war chest to fight additional regulations is in excess of $150 million. Compare that with the budgets of environmental and public health groups that advocate for consumers, for you and me. Their combined budgets are about one-eighth that, if that, of the American Chemical Council. Again and again, in every sector of the economy, there's an NRA, there's a pharma, there's an American Chemical Council acting as barriers to progress. We need more affordable health care, clean air, homes free of deadly toxins, food that isn't contaminated or devoid of nutritional value. And we need a government, folks, that works for the people, not for the special interests with deep pockets who are more interested in maximizing profits than anything else. I'm convinced that the way forward is to get big money out of the political system. That's why I wrote Nation on the Take, which, as Don mentioned, you can now buy. You can pre-order it. I'm deeply invested in this work to improve access to health care, of course. I remain deeply invested. But stories that I uncovered while researching this book, like the people who are sickened every day because of unregulated chemicals, and like Bill and Faith Wilderick, who are just barely able to make ends meet because they're having to pay such high co-payments because Bill has to take Sovaldi, now Hervoni, because of hepatitis C. Those folks can convince me that for us to make further progress in healthcare or anything else, we have to change the process. We know, and we know this is going to be a heavy lift. But we know also that we can do this if we put our minds to it. Just look who our Surgeon General is. Dr. Murthy is the nation's top doc because you guys wouldn't give up. Now, here's another non-healthcare example. 4 years ago, SOPA, the Stop Online Piracy Act, was introduced with bipartisan congressional support. This despite experts who said it could criminalize free speech. Opponents of SOPA began to mobilize. They enlisted the support of heavy hitters like Google and Reddit, as well as thousands of smaller websites. In early 2012, they coordinated an internet service blackout in protest of the bill. Google collected more than 7 million signatures on a petition. Companies that supported SOPA were boycotted. In short order, they reframed the debate on their own terms. They triumphed when SOPA was shelved, and they kept the coalition intact to pressure the FCC to enshrine net neutrality. This year, they quashed the $45 billion Comcast Time Warner deal, which threatened to undermine competition and cause prices to go up. If this broad coalition was able to mobilize the public to protect freedom of speech on the internet, we can do the same thing. Across this nation, there are many examples of folks mobilizing and fighting the influence of big money and crony capitalism, as I chronicle in Nation on the Take. And they're scoring some important victories. Down in Tallahassee, people came together last year to pass an anti-corruption ballot initiative. They did so by forging a coalition between Tea Party activists and progressive. Grover Norquist followers worked shoulder to shoulder with people who undoubtedly are now wearing Feel the Burn t-shirts. And by the end of 2016, activists in a half dozen states from California to Maryland are working to get reform measures on their ballots. So you see, real reform is taking shape at the state and local levels, and real reform can and will bubble up to Congress and the White House if we attack this threat to our very way of life with a sense of urgency, just as the SOPA activists did. Let me close with this. To get the health care reform that we need to bring down the remaining barriers to care, we need to come to terms with the fact that because of big money and crony capitalism, we will face even more resistance than we faced when the Affordable Care Act was being written a few years ago. The entrenched special interests that are profiting from the status quo will spend whatever it takes to keep those barriers intact, as long as we let them spend whatever it takes. Folks, there's no cause that's more urgent. This is about nothing short of the future of the American experiment. So my ultimate call to action this afternoon is this. Sign up to fight big money and crony capitalism, not just for our own sake, but also for the sake of our children and grandchildren. What we need to do, folks, is raise one hell of a ruckus. And I hope you'll join me in doing just that. Thank you.